We are now open to questions. So we'll take some from both the in-person audience and online. And we'll start over here. And please state your name and organization when asking a question. Oh, yes. And our two speakers will drag their chairs up to the front to make it easier to see you all. So I'll pass it back here first.
Thank you, P.V. Sundaresh, Africa Bureau Climate Change Advisor. That was an interesting presentation. I was kind of intrigued by the graph for the quantity of seats. You know, the DD hybrid, despite being lower price, is only, you know, you can only acquire, what, three times less than, or four times less than the inbred? Is that correct? So what was the cost for, what was the reason for a lower, is it lower adoption rates? Or I'm still kind of curious that price is not a big driver there. And the other thing was if you can unpack a little bit more the impact of socioeconomic diversity across the three districts that you looked at. Thank you.
Yeah. By the fact that hybrids generally have lower seeding rates, fewer seeds are required because of the hybrid vigor that results from heterosis, the hybridization process. Fewer seeds are required to cultivate a particular area of land.
But that would assume that the total amount of acreage that is covered by the less number of seeds is the same. So that would imply that there are three times or four times as much, you know, gain in acreage, right? Because the total number of seeds is about four times less.
Yeah. So we have the same farmers are represented by each of these demand curves. So we have willingness to pay for the DT hybrid and the DT cultivar for the same set of farmers. Socioeconomic characteristics differences between the three districts. Bhojpur and Nevada are both relatively wealthy, relatively developed. The capital of Bihar is Patna, which is in this district right here. So Bhojpur is in close proximity to Patna. A lot of people from Bhojpur migrate to Patna for labor. So it's generally relatively wealthy. Farmers generally own moderately larger tracts of land. They have access to better irrigation. They are also, a lot of the farmers here are rapidly adopting SRI. I think there was a farmer in Bhojpur who claimed to have yielded 22 tons per hectare using SRI, which is about four times the national average. Madhubani is a very poor district, very underdeveloped. Any other like specifics that you?
What I was looking for was: is there a difference in, you know, how does that socioeconomic difference between these sites impact their risk averseness, or how willing are they to adopt a new technology? Because I,
sure,
I might have missed it, but clearly the socioeconomic issue is a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. So what we found was that, largely driven by differences in wealth, we believe, farmers in Bhojpur and Nevada were willing to pay more for the DT seeds, both the DT hybrid and the DT inbred. Farmers in Madhubani were willing to pay less, but we think that's largely driven by income rather than necessarily geographic heterogeneity or anything like that. Does that address your question? Or? Well,
I was just trying to see if there was, because it could go both ways, right? If a farmer has had a very bad year,
they might be more willing to try out something new that doesn't put them in the same situation. So they might be less, you know, they might be more, they can probably take a larger risk, because they've already lost something, so there's nothing to lose if I go with something new that has a promise of giving me something better.
Or it could go by the other way too.
So the socioeconomic status of the farmer has a huge impact on how it plays out, and I was trying to see how that disaggregates between the three districts, your whole results. So if you were to plot the results for individual districts, how would it play out? You know, what would be the dynamics that emerge?
Individual districts or individual households, really.
Yeah.
You want to take that, or should I? We are working on some sort of the gender dynamics of this particular choice experiment that's a separate paper we're working on. The feminization of agriculture has huge implications for many different things. If you're talking about some of the work CISA has been doing on resource conserving and labor saving machinery and equipment, I think there's a strong case to be made, or at least it's an empirical question as to whether women will own or custom hire or rent or use labor saving machinery, particularly for farm production. I think there's a lot of heterogeneity in how households manage female labor and labor more generally. They use their own household labor. They also hire labor, depending on their relative wealth, from other communities. So understanding those dynamics is really important. In this particular case, you had female-headed households, but you also interviewed women. We interviewed women and men in different situations. And what were your observations?
This analysis is still ongoing. One of the things that we observed was that, on average, women were generally more risk averse and were willing to had a higher marginal valuation for the types of seeds that didn't necessarily produce better yields under normal conditions, but had less variable yields under moderate drought stress. We're continuing to try to unpack that more and see, you know, the relationship between see to a greater degree the relationship between women's role within the household and their role in decision making, coupled with their risk preferences and their preferences for the different seed characteristics. But to touch on something else that I think the question was addressing, there's a lot of problems of asymmetric information when it comes to women and the feminization of agriculture and their access to these new technologies. For one, it seems largely that women don't know where to go to get information about new seeds, new technologies. On the other hand, extension agents and private sector custom hire service providers or seed dealers don't exactly view women as a potential market. So some of the work that we're doing in CISA, in Odisha in particular, is utilizing a system of non-governmental organizations that have women self-help groups, and we're trying to bring these two parties together and, you know, create opportunities for sharing of information and human capital building so that women know where they can go to access information. The service providers and the seed dealers can view women as, you know, potential markets, which may be, you know, increasingly important as this feminization of labor increases, as more and more men migrate to the city, or as more and more men take up non-farm employment as a result of the so India has a program called the Mahatma Gandhi National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, which offers rural laborers up to 100 days of non-farm work at a market wage. So as more and more men take advantage of this, this may result in more and more women being the primary farm decision makers. As we're able to facilitate this information sharing, it may be beneficial for the women that are left behind.
Thanks for your talk. I appreciate any study that looks or tries to tease out risk-averse behavior. Not easy. This is a study design question. When you have the three choices of potential seed and then the one that people use currently, were you aware of what their current seed was? Because, of course, the status quo would affect their choices.
Absolutely.
So if you did know what the seed choices were, did you aggregate the data based on what their current perspective was?
So we collected information on what their current seed was, as well as the characteristics of that seed, or at least their perceptions of those characteristics, and then used that when we were doing our statistical modeling to see how the hypothetical seeds compared with their status quo.
Impact if they were using a particular type, those folks went to type A as opposed
We weren't able to parse anything out like that. What we were able to see was that only 11% of farmers, only 11% of total choice scenarios. Each farmer was presented with 9 of those choice scenarios, different ones, not the same one 9 times. But only in 11% of those total number of choice scenarios did farmers actually prefer their status quo rather than the hypothetical ones that we were including. Yes, we had, yeah.
Tom Timberg, consultant. There were a number of just background clarifications. You do know what kind, who is selling seed or distributing seed at the moment in these three areas. I gather from what you were saying that the Sabhagri seed would be distributed through some public sector channel. Whereas there are some, to what extent are competitive private sector channels actually available in any of the three areas? The other thing which, you know, the Dre's study indicates that the Mahatma Gandhi scheme is basically not working in Bihar. Other things are working, roads, et cetera. Now, to the extent that that's the case, on the other hand, the people are moving out of Bihar, migrating at rapid rates. Are either of those facts at all noticeable in, for example, a lower level of effeminization in the labor forces, differential levels of effeminization in the two prosperous areas and the Nepali border area? And of course, then there's the final area issue, which is any Nepali border area also has a lot of smuggling going back and forth over the border. And I guess you have a question of the reliability of responses in circumstances where a large amount of the market may be illegal.
So I can take a few of those questions. So in general, seed is retailed to farmers through, in India, rice seed, through private retail shops, right? They source their seed from wholesalers who obtain it from state-owned enterprises or from the private sector. And the difference between where they source it from is usually very observable. So an openly pollinated, you know, an inbred rice, an improved rice cultivar, is typically sold, you know, in a large burlap bag of, I think, a mun or 50 kg or sometimes smaller. Usually if it's certified, you know, it has a tag stapled on it from the certification, seed certification agency, whereas hybrid rice is packaged typically in, you know, in a polythene bag, in a proper plastic bag with labeling and marketing and lots of pretty pictures and things like that, and they're in much smaller quantities. So farmers may obtain, for the most part, their seed from the same places, but it's fairly obvious what is coming from a parastatal or state-owned seed company, and what is coming from a private sector. That is what is like a high-quality hybrid. There are also some private companies that are in the market with producing inbred these open-pollinated varieties, so they get the germplasm from the research system, or from these parastatals, and they actually produce their own wheat and rice seed as well. And they label it slightly differently and whatnot. They sell it usually alongside fertilizer. But farmers can see these things quite distinctly. I think for the most part, those are the channels that they're purchasing through, right? And now I've forgotten the other questions.
One was about, so Narega is not successful in Bihar.
They'll sell Sabhagri and they will know what they actually bought. I mean, so it's a moving target, but the report was it wasn't working.
Yeah. Could you remind me
of that? Does that affect, for example, do you have a lower level of feminization than you would have expected in the market? Is the social compositions of the farmers you're dealing with different than you, because of that? In other words, you're talking as if what is probably true elsewhere in India, the Mahatma Gandhi scheme had some effect on the farmers and therefore on their behavior. And I'm just wondering if it's the case.
Sure. Yeah, we didn't. So I apologize if I was misleading before. We weren't specifically looking at Narega or its impacts on feminization of labor or anything like that. I was just trying to paint a picture of some of the work that we're doing in CISA overall outside of this particular study. So we didn't focus on that dimension of these changing labor asset gender dynamics. We did have some female headed households in our sample. It's difficult to compare that to what one might expect from the national average because we used a semi-purposive, semi-random sampling scheme. We were primarily interested, because this is a rice technology, we were interested in rice-growing households. So it's difficult to parse down what the effect of Narega is on rice-growing households versus other, you know, Pulse or whatever.
The question on Nepal.
There's all kinds of black market activity, but it doesn't really affect the rice economy.
So there's obviously a huge cross-border trade between these two countries. As far as agricultural inputs go, the trade is generally northward bound. Fertilizer especially flows over the border to Nepal, and so do sort of those Indian subsidies.
Nicely subsidized.
Right. So there are lots of market distortions there. But in this particular study, and the sample of farmers that we were looking at, we're very careful to gather information on their sources of income, their household expenditures as a proxy for income, and lots of other measures. So in a sense, if there are any explanators that in theory or in practice would explain their behavior with respect to DT rights, we control for it and we account for it. I can't see any reason. I can't see any sort of impact pathway between smuggling and preferences for DT rice and or rice traits, but we could theorize about those.
And this is a hypothetical situation, so there's no actual market transaction. So I'm with David. I don't quite see how a pathway where
that may be the answer. That is, any distortions in the real market shouldn't have any effect on the responses.
I think we have a question from our online audience.
Yeah, I've got two, actually. One is just a clarifying question from Dick Tinsley in Colorado State. What is the mechanism for drought tolerance? Is it an ability to withstand heat or better able to mine more water from the soil? And the second one is from Loretta Burns, who's joining us from Seattle in BMGF. Does your research consider consumer preferences for certain grain types in addition to farmer preferences?
So to answer the second question first, we did not explicitly consider different grain types. In our set of instructions that were read to each of the respondents, they were asked to consider the attributes that were not explicitly included to be identical across seed alternatives. So grain type was assumed to be uniform across the different alternatives.
Let me just jump in here. It's a good question to ask in the context, especially of hybrid rice, because maybe the participant realizes this, but one of the constraints to hybrid rice adoption, especially in Bangladesh and India, recently has precisely been the cooking or taste qualities of the rice. Now, that's something that breeders will eventually address, I assume, over the next 5 to 10 years, but it has been a constraint to adoption. But in this particular case, we assumed constant attributes on taste and cooking.
And the first question, the mechanism for drought tolerance, that's also a really good question. There are several potential avenues by which drought tolerance can be introduced. Dehydration tolerance, deeper roots so that it can extract water from lower levels of the soil, leaf curling so that it reduces exposure to sunlight. These are all avenues that plant breeders have been exploring as a way of introducing drought tolerance. We didn't explicitly indicate any. We're agnostic when it comes to the actual mechanism for drought tolerance. When you talk to the breeders from Erie who have done work on Sabagidan, what they'll say is that it's just bred to be drought resistant. The parental lines that have come together for breeding have inherent drought tolerance, and they don't specify a particular pathway by which that's achieved.
We have a question back here.
Hi, Matthew Krause from Partnering for Innovation. If you could go back to the yield curve with the drought overlap. At the very beginning.
Very beginning.
Yeah. It appears in any of these that the yields are already going down prior to the drought being identified. So I'm wondering, is this just an effect of a lag where they're determining a drought is in a certain year and it's already happening and there's already yield effects? Or are farmers perhaps making some decisions to get out of this crop? And if they are making a decision, might that be the time when you would want to bring in the drought-tolerant seed varieties or market them at that point?
So I think, if I'm understanding correctly, I think what you're observing is just a function that we're observing the yields and the droughts at discrete points in time. And so, you know, this is the average yield in 2001-2002, and then this is the average yield for the monsoon month, for 2002-2003. There's no continuous curvature between those periods. So the downward trend isn't so much a downward trend as it is, this is what's observed at one point and this is what's observed at another. And what we observe by tracing it out like this is the downward slope.
All right, we have time for a few more questions. Do we have any more from online? And then I'll grab John over here.
Yes, this one comes from Jim Tarrant from IRG Agility, who is joining us here from D.C., he recently came back from Indonesia where he was evaluating a climate service, basically seasonal drought early warning systems for irrigated rice cropping systems vulnerable to ENSO drought and La Nina floods, combined with a climate field school to help farmers to understand how to use climate forecasts for their cropping calendars. Are the drought-tolerant researchers looking at such adaptation measures in their research?
Well, in this particular study, no, we weren't. There are early warning systems being developed and information systems being developed to convey that type of information to farmers. But no, that wasn't within the scope of this study.
I have, I guess, three quick questions. The first question is as far as the spread of hybrid rice, forget drought tolerance. It's like 4 or 5% across India. How is that? Is Bihar an area where there's a good bit of hybrid rice already? And how, you know, and then leading from that, there probably would be some information out there that you could draw on sort of willingness to pay for just hybrids. I mean, you'd have some primary data rather than having to disentangle it from yours. My second quick question is, it's kind of interesting with the cases, the four cases, if there's any thought about, this is, the retroactive suggestion, but there's something about using kind of farm recurrent method, but coupling with like a policy instrument, like an insurance instrument or something like that, if they're willing to, I don't know if that was something that was considered, you're smiling, so maybe it was.
Oh, cool.
And my third question is kind of just a broader picture question was, so certainly this would be of use if I'm a seed company, I'd want to know that, you know, farmers are willing to pay more for hybrids versus inbreds and how it changes based on their land holding. Are there other kind of audiences, like would this be something of utility to a state government on how they would shift a particular policy to encourage more adoption of drought tolerance? I'm just curious about the audiences for this kind of result.
Tell you what, I'll take the first two, you take the third.
What was the third?
Who's the audience?
Who's the audience? Good question.
So the first question was about hybrids in Bihar. Bihar is actually one of the states where hybrids have been very, very successful. Some of my colleagues at the New Delhi office have been studying the expansion of hybrid rice in Bihar, and they've actually using state agricultural statistics, they have found that 60% of farmers in Bihar are using hybrids. That seems a bit high to me, but the hybrid rice.
We have our data as well from CESA.
Yeah, and the CESA baseline data, which we have, shows, you know, high numbers as well in specific geographically concentrated areas, 40% or something like that. So hybrids are very, very successful in Bihar. They do have subsidies on hybrids, so that does help the overall dissemination. In terms of willingness to pay for hybrids, the novelty of this particular methodology is it allows you to capture willingness to pay in a hypothetical situation. When you actually have the good on the market, you can observe willingness to pay by varying prices within the market, and those are probably a real indicator of what people are willing to pay. Now I forgot your second question.
It was about the insurance instrument that you
asked. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because we are actually preparing to launch a similar type study in Bangladesh, where we are actually bundling a drought tolerant cultivar with a weather based index insurance.
Hypothetical.
We are.
And then the third question was, what's the audience, the policy audience for this type of work? That's a great question. And when you're dealing with policy in India, like I said, it's an incredibly complex landscape. I think one of the communities, if you will, that we're focusing on here is the private sector. I think that while USAID and the CGIAR, of which we're a part, and many others, you know, are still very closely aligned with the Indian public research and extension systems, and we believe that, you know, they're an important means of reaching smallholders with new technologies. I think we all recognize that the private sector has an important role to play in developing and delivering new crops or new seeds, new traits, let's say. So reaching out to the private sector and saying, look, you know, your decision makers have to think about, well, what are you going to invest in things like hybrid rice? What are you going to invest in markets like Bihar or Jharkhand or Chhattisgarh, you know, very marginal areas? And how are you going to work with the public sector to get the traits you might want, whether it's the Indian Council on Agricultural Research or, you know, the land-grant university system in the U.S., like UC Davis? So really, the policy discussion starts for us in some cases with the private sector. And then we bring in, you know, their counterparts in the Indian research system and in other communities to figure out how best to go about investing in solutions, ideally together.
All right, well, we are actually running up on the end of our time. You're all right with one more?
No, we are.
All right. This will be our final question, and then we'll get wrapped up. And while this question is going on, if you wouldn't mind filling out the surveys that are on your seats, those are always helpful for us, even if you've attended multiple times. You can either leave them on your seats or drop them off at a table or with one of our staff.
Larry Paulson, retired USAID ag officer with lots of experience in that region. Question about farmers' perception, apart from the hypotheticals and thought experiments about risk-taking or risk aversion. It's generally considered that, you know, 20% to 40% is, or maybe 40% improvement in a yield is sort of a minimum that be actually identifiable by a farmer, maybe down to 20%, compared to, for example, Green Revolution technology that quadrupled yields. So I'm wondering how do farmers perceive this actual variety that has 20 to 30% improvement under certain conditions? Is it worth investing a lot in, or does it need to improve before it's worth spending a lot on marketing?
I think that's an excellent question. And unfortunately, it's not something, these technologies are so new that we don't really have a good sense of, you know, whether farmers can actually perceive these yield advantages. The yield advantages that I referred to before were based on agronomist field trials. And so we don't really have a good sense for how it performs in farmers' fields and whether farmers can actually detect those differences. But that's definitely something that is of very keen policy relevance.
You I would also say that post-Green Revolution, we're in an era where farmers are considering more than just yield. Yield is always important. But even with hybrids, which have a significant yield bump, you're only talking 15 to 30%. So that may be observable, given the adoption patterns we're seeing. It may not be observable. It's a good question. And you know, the circumstances under which it's observable and comparable are across, you know, different plots, different years, are complicated. But I think a lot of farmers that we work with in CISA and in our work are really thinking more than just yield. Obviously, like I said, yield is important, but duration and the ability to put in a rubby winter crop, especially a horticulture crop, not necessarily wheat, but anything else, is increasingly, I think, something that farmers are recognizing as profitable because market infrastructure is improving in some areas, and you know, horticulture crops, vegetables, fruits, whatever it may be, can make a real big difference to household welfare and income. So duration is a big one. And some of my colleagues in Bangladesh have actually done some work on this, where they've actually looked, referring back to the earlier question, on grain quality, taste, and cooking quality. A lot of the markets for rice in Bangladesh, for instance, have diversified such that there are now higher premia being paid for finer rices, you know, the aromatic, slender, bold, whatever they are. And I think farmers are becoming more conscious of those quality traits. We're in Haryana once, and I should have realized this, but basmati, which many of us eat here in the States, right? The fine, slender, aromatic, long grain rice that everybody eats and loves has a yield of 1.5 tons per hectare. That's a quarter of what, you know, other farmers are able to get on the hectare with other less fine varieties. Yet they grow it because it commands a higher price in the market. So.
All right, well, on behalf of AgriLinks, I'd like to thank David and Patrick for your very detailed and clear presentation and your great responses to the questions. And thank you to our audience, both in person and online, for supporting Ag Sector Council. And we'll be in touch with the post-event products from this event and with details on our March event. So thank you all very much. Thank you.